This is an ABC podcast.
Hello for Marlo and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. It's Thursday, August 21. I'm Kyle Evans filling in for Agit Dupo, who is off sick today. But stay tuned because we've got a big show coming up. We'll hear why a project to reclaim low-lying Tuvalu is a prime example of development infrastructure.
It's something about the hospital system and how it's acting to pick up the complications after surgery and respond when something goes wrong.
We'll also look at why cancer surgery can be particularly harmful for Indigenous Māori.
Amelia Earhart on a globe-girdling flight with navigator Fred Noonan.
And could Donald Trump hold the secrets to Amelia Earhart's disappearance? CNMI's Congresswoman thinks he might. All that and more coming up. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first, this week's developments have been unfolding between two Pacific nations and their critical agreements with Australia. In Vanuatu, Prime Minister Jonathan Nuppat has again fronted the media to discuss the Nakumal Agreement, a sweeping 10-year, half-billion-dollar partnership with Canberra covering everything from climate resilience and infrastructure to digital capacity and security. Meanwhile, in Nauru, the Albanese government is pressing the island state over a proposed billion-dollar deal with the Chinese company, warning of the risks tied to the opaque financial agreements and Beijing's expanding footprint in the region. The ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts, has the latest.
The Prime Minister got a few questions on the Nakumal Agreement. The two most interesting bits, I guess, were on one, the question around what security concessions, if any, Vanuatu has made Australia, and two, this question over his repeated claim that Australia has offered what he's called visa-free travel to people from Vanuatu under this agreement. Now, on the security agreement, the Prime Minister was again adamant that Australia had not won any veto powers under this agreement for national security. He was asked, for example, about the Falapilli Union, which, as you know, allows Australia to essentially hold veto power over Tuvalu's national security decisions under that agreement. Mr. Nuppat was adamant that nothing like that existed in the Vanuatu-Australia agreement, saying the situation with Tuvalu is, quote, totally different, and that Vanuatu would still welcome other donor partners to assist in security. In other words, the Prime Minister saying that Vanuatu will still be able to engage with outside partners, presumably including China, on security and policing matters under this agreement. That's not a surprise as such, but it's interesting to see him reaffirm that publicly ahead of the agreement being released. The other interesting question is this question around visa-free travel. Mr. Nuppat said about a month ago that he wouldn't sign the agreement unless visa-free travel was put into it, but he sounded a little bit more vague about it over the last week or so. And when he was asked again outright whether visa-free travel would be allowed, he seemed to suggest that there won't necessarily be such an agreement in this agreement that's going to be signed by the Prime Minister in just a few weeks, saying that the details are still being worked out and would come at a, quote, later stage as part of what he's calling a subsidiary agreement, which officials are still discussing. So we don't yet have clarity, but it sounds like there will only be a broad commitment to visa-free travel or to loosening travel restrictions from Australia. Certainly nothing as sweeping as visa-free travel, and it sounds like it's still going to have to be worked out down the line by officials.
Talking of treaties, Australia has also asked Nauru for more details about a potential billion-dollar investment agreement that the Nauru government signed with a Chinese company. What are the details around this and what has Australia had to say?
Well, the details are very, very difficult to find, in brief, because the government of Nauru has provided absolutely no information about this beyond one rather bland statement that it put up last week. This is basically an assertion made by Nauru about a week ago that a company called the China Rural Revitalization and Development Corporation had agreed to a quote, phase one investment project proposal valued at approximately $1 billion Australian. Obviously, a vast sum of money for Nauru, given its population's only about 12,000. But the foreign minister is essentially saying that this will allow this company to pour money into a whole range of different sectors, including phosphate mining, tourism, infrastructure, including marine infrastructure, the list goes on. Now, what's mysterious about this is that there's very, very little public information about this company. The ABC and others have tried to track down more detail about the CRRDC and have found no evidence the company exists. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it does mean that its public records are very scanty or perhaps non-existent. And then, of course, the other question is around the sheer scale of this asserted agreement for an investment proposal. On the face of it, analysts say that $1 billion is simply far too vast a sum for Nauru, given its population, that there's simply no practical way that any company could pledge investments of that scale in a meaningful way, given the number of people who live there. The margins, the profit, and the bandwidth simply isn't there. So at this stage, there's still an awful lot of mystery over this, and perhaps unsurprisingly, Australian officials are politely asking for more information, including the foreign minister, Penny Wong, when she met with her Nauru counterpart in Suva last week. Worth remembering here that Australia and Nauru signed a treaty in December last year that does give Australia, again, effective veto rights over Nauru's decisions in the national security space. So Australia, you'd imagine, is one, checking to see whether this so-called deal is real or substantial in any way, and two, if it is, whether there's anything in it that might trigger concerns under that treaty.
Yeah, a few questions still to come on that one, as the ABC's foreign affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts, and he was speaking there with Jordan Fennell. A project to reclaim land in low-lying Tuvalu is being held up at a major infrastructure conference as a prime example of how to deliver meaningful, lasting work that helps people adapt to climate change. The conference has heard financing for infrastructure projects in the region is ramping, with billions of dollars worth of contracts up for grabs in the coming years. Liam Fox reports.
Few countries are more vulnerable to the impacts of climate change and rising seas than Tuvalu, as the country's Prime Minister, Feleti Teo, explained to delegates at the Pacific Infrastructure Conference in Brisbane.
Tuvalu consists of 9 atolls. Total land area is a mere 26 square kilometres, and each atoll has a maximum elevation of less than 4 metres above mean sea level.
That's why the Tuvalu Climate Adaptation Project, TCAP, is such a big deal.
TCAP has become our national flagship adaptation project that carries two principal objectives. The first one is to fortify and to enhance the resilience and adaptability of Tuvalu's coastlines. And secondly, to reclaim much-needed land for public use and infrastructure.
Financed by the Green Climate Fund and the Australian government, the project achieved a major milestone last year when 7 hectares of reclaimed land in the capital Funafuti was officially handed over to the government. The work was carried out by Australian company Hall Contracting, which has experience in civil engineering and marine infrastructure work around the region. CEO Cameron Hall says this project was particularly satisfying to be involved in.
When you come to the end of a project, the satisfaction that particularly our guys, the Australians and expats, get from seeing what they've managed to do, you know, they've created infrastructure and also transferred a whole lot of skills, it is quite satisfying, yes. It's a different sort of satisfaction to building infrastructure in an already developed place.
Though it wasn't without its challenges.
These islands, to get to them, you know, you need to fly for 2 days and then get on a boat and travel for another day. So you need to bring everything with you. There's no Bunnings up the road. We go in fully self-sufficient from water, food, wastewater treatment, power, everything we bring in and everything we take out.
Lending institutions like the Asian Development Bank and the Australian Infrastructure Financing Facility for the Pacific have ramped up financing in recent years. The conference heard billions of dollars worth of contracts for infrastructure projects will be coming online in the near future, and businesses are being encouraged to bid. Mr. Hall says more Australian companies should step up, but they need to know what they're getting into.
It's a difficult place to work, but it's not impossible. Most of the projects have got something to do with climate risks or weather events, which suggests that at times it can be bad, which it can, and can really affect construction projects. So I would encourage people to look at it, other companies to look at it, but go in eyes wide open with the risks that are around it.
Back in Tuvalu, the climate adaptation project is far from over. Like all Pacific Island nations, Tuvalu's infrastructure needs are critical and considerable. Prime Minister Teo says plans are underway to put the newly reclaimed land to use.
Significant public infrastructure will be required on that reclaimed land to support development, including, for example, roads, water and electricity supply, housing and public building.
He says the Australian government and the Asian Development Bank have confirmed funding for future reclamation work as well.
That was Liam Fox reporting there.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Kyle Evans filling in for Aggie Tupo, who's off sick today. Hope you're having a fantastic Thursday morning. Quick recap of our top story. In Nauru, the Albanese government is pressing the island state over a proposed $1 billion deal with a Chinese company, warning of the risks tied to opaque financial arrangements and Beijing's expanding footprint in the region.
Now, what's mysterious about this is that there's very, very little public information about this company. The ABC and others have tried to track down more detail about the CRRDC and have found no evidence the company exists.
Pacific Beat.
Well, registrations for the second annual round of Australia's Pacific Engagement Visa ballot close on Monday. The permanent residency visa, exclusively for citizens from the Pacific and Timor-Leste, provides the opportunity for up to 3,000 residents to live, work and study in Australia each year. Natasha Turia is a PhD scholar at the Department of Pacific Affairs and research officer at the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University. She told Lucy Cooper it's been a slow start to the visa rollout.
When the visa was first announced and a job offer was a requirement for the visa after you were selected from the ballot, randomly selected, we always knew that securing a job offer would be the biggest hurdle. And since its launch last year, that remains the biggest hurdle for many applicants to get over that last line to qualify for a visa. So from what we've heard so far, and the latest data we have is as of October last year, of the 3,000 PEV winners, only around 1,000 visas were granted. So that's not halfway or even 50% of visas. So it's been a slow start, but hopefully, I guess, as the PEV becomes more popular here in Australia, particularly among employers, that we'll see an increase in ballot winners' ability to secure those job offers.
What countries really stood out in regard to the Pacific Engagement Visa?
Visa data that we've been able to receive from Department of Home Affairs, which is only up until end of April, and based on the number of applications that have been submitted by ballot winners, relative to the quotas against each country, Fiji stands out as the best performing country in terms of converting visa applications onto visa grants. So they had a success rate of 93% compared to PNG, Timor-Leste and Vanuatu, who are in the 10 to 20% success range.
Do we know why not all lottery winners applied?
We can really only assume reasons why. And number one, perhaps it just wasn't the right time for that applicant. Sometimes there's personal issues that come up that make it incredibly difficult for them to complete lodgement or at least applying for the visa before the cutoff date. Number two, they probably didn't even know they won. Number three, they probably thought you needed a job offer before the cutoff date. And because they didn't have a job offer, they just didn't complete that visa application.
The Australian government has said 1,000 visas under the PEV have so far been offered. Would you consider this a success or a failure, given we know up to 3,000 could have been granted?
It's good to be fair, given that this is Australia's first time to launch any kind of exclusive PR pathway to the Pacific. So given that this is the first time that Australia has ever done this, I think that, you know, expecting 100% success rate in its first round would have been, you know, quite a high expectation on Australia. So the fact that they've already been able to just reach 1,000, I think, in this first release of the PEV is great. It could have been worse. It's still great, positive news for the PEV. And what would be, I guess, critical moving forward is if those numbers drop off after successive PEV rounds.
From your experience and background of the Pacific Engagement Visa, what recommendations do you have that you think should be implemented to, you know, deem this next ballot and then, you know, visa allocations, I suppose, a success this time round?
I think given that the Tuvalu Treaty stream has also come out, and they obviously have slightly more liberal visa settings, one of which does not require a job offer, I would expect all 280 visas for under the Tuvalu Treaty stream to be granted. If that is the case for this round, it means that the job offer under the PEV for the other 11 participating countries makes sense for Australia to do one of two things. Number one, and this is probably the most radical, is to remove the job offer requirement altogether, similar to the Tuvalu Treaty stream. And number two, they grant a six-month conditional visa after meeting all the other visa requirements, less the job offer, so that the PEV winners can enter Australia and apply for jobs here. This means that instead of asking for a financial proof of evidence of 12 months, it would only be for 6 months because the conditional visa is only for a period of 6 months.
Natasha Turia, Research Officer at the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University, and she was speaking there with Lucy Cooper.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
To Tonga now, where an international team of scientists is investigating the Hunga Tonga Hangaha Apai volcanic eruption in 2022. It was the most powerful volcanic eruption in the last 110 years. Chief Scientist Rebecca Carey from the University of Tasmania says the team will study many facets of the eruption.
There are three themes to this research. The first theme is to understand why this eruption was so powerful. Are there other volcanoes like Hunga that are littering the Pacific, the Southwest Pacific, and to assess the volcanic risk of those volcanoes. The second theme is to do with underwater seafloor cabling. So this eruption produced underwater, high-speed, 100-kilometre-an-hour sediment flows, and those sediment flows disrupted the domestic cable that connects the domestic Tongan islands, and it also disrupted the international cable, which cut Tonga off from the world for about 3 weeks. Mm. So we're trying to understand those sediment flows, understand if there's any sediment left on the volcano that could be disrupted through earthquakes, that could disrupt those new cables that have been laid down. And the third theme of this research is around the biology. So these underwater submarine sediment flows, they essentially destroyed all of the underwater biological communities to around 50 kilometres from source. So things like worms and barnacles and snails and things like that completely wiped out. And so we're coming back after the eruption was, that these biological communities were surveyed after the eruption in 2022 when they recognised the devastation. And we'll be revisiting those sites in 2025 on this voyage to understand how they're recovering and where those recruits are coming from. Are they local endemic species to Tonga, or have they arrived on the big regional Pacific-wide currents from elsewhere?
So it's a big gathering of scientists, isn't it? You're all going to be studying different aspects of the eruption. How will it all be organised?
That's right. We're an international team. So it includes a Tongan Geological Services staff who's here to learn about ship-based operations and research, but also provide her perspectives on Tongan volcanoes. We've also got some scientists from New Zealand, Australia, the US. I think that probably covers it. And so we're also multidisciplinary. So I'm a volcanologist. I'm really focused on volcanics and volcanic hazards. But we've got biologists on board, and we've also got some marine spatial scientists who will provide us with data products such as the seafloor topography and other data products that the Tongans need in order to inform risk and hazard in the Pacific.
As you said, Rebecca, the Hunga volcano is one of hundreds of shallow submarine volcanoes in the region. How much is known about them now and their eruption risk?
We know where they are, or at least the big ones, but we don't really understand the hazards associated with submarine volcanoes. In contrast, on land, when we see volcanoes erupt, we've got a wealth of observations from ground sensors, satellite sensors, and our own eyes. And so our observations have been used to develop models to understand volcanic eruptions and the past behaviour of volcanoes. And so the risk assessments associated with volcanic hazards on land are very well understood and very sophisticated. But because we don't really understand how eruption into the water influences eruption dynamics, how the pressure of the water column makes eruptions explode or makes them suppress, the submarine volcanoes that litter the Southwest Pacific, they're not really included in any risk assessments for countries like Tonga, Vanuatu, for example. And so we're hoping that the information that we gather from Hunga volcano can be used to inform the Tongan government in terms of their assessments, but that information can also be applied to other volcanoes that, like Hunga, in those Pacific island nations, to help them inform what the submarine volcanic risk is associated with those volcanic centres.
That was the Chief Scientist Rebecca Carey speaking there. To Aotearoa, New Zealand, where new research reveals Indigenous Māori are almost twice as likely as non-Māori to die after major cancer-related surgery. The study found Māori patients experience complications such as infections and organ failure, leading to higher rates of death. Dr. Cameron Wells, a doctoral candidate in surgery at the Waipapa Taumata Rau University of Auckland, spoke to Aki Tupo about the confronting data.
The reason why we did this project was really to try and dive into why and understand the things that are causing those disparities so that then we can do something about them. It's not that there's something different about Māori patients. It's not about how sick they are or how bad their cancer is or whether they have an emergency operation. It's something about the hospital system and how it's acting to pick up the complications after surgery and respond when something goes wrong.
What are they, you know, in regards to the disparities between Māori and non-Māori though?
Having a GP, being screened for various cancers, all the way through to where this study was, kind of having an operation and the care after it. We know that there are lots of examples of hospital staff communicating poorly with Māori patients and their whānau. I suspect that that's one of the big contributing factors to this. Māori patients being more likely to die after complications suggests that those might have been picked up later and perhaps early warning signs of something going wrong has been missed, or doctors and surgeons made different decisions about treatment, whether to go back for another operation to try and fix problems, whether people go to the intensive care unit or get other treatments. There's something in how the health system is responding to complications differently for Māori patients, and because of that, they're more likely to die.
Did you sort of look into around ages and even like gender? Who were you really looking at in regards to the disparities?
That's a really good point. So in this study, we looked at 30,000 cancer operations in New Zealand. We looked at people of all ages, all ethnicities, and then narrowed that down to really make a comparison for Māori and Pākehā in New Zealand. We found that Māori patients on average were 10 years younger than non-Māori. I think that speaks to a lot of the upstream disparities and are more likely to get cancers at younger ages. It's not something about Māori patients being different that's causing this. It's something about how the hospital systems are responding.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Well, I mean, what are maybe specific barriers, you know, that, our Māori people are facing within the health system itself?
Communication, unconscious biases and assumptions that play into everyday decisions that get made by doctors and nurses, and even just the way the system works. Models of healthcare with kind of a one-size-fits-all approach tend not to work as well for Māori. There's lots of examples of that across other parts of healthcare. They have been built with a very European mindset, and perhaps some of those things aren't working as well for Māori patients. Over the last decade or two, things have gotten a lot better in terms of outcomes for Pākehā, but those same improvements haven't happened for Māori.
There was the acronym FTR. Failure to rescue. Are you able to sort of elaborate on that and really how much that plays into the response mechanisms that the health system are giving our Māori people?
Yeah, that's a great question. Now, the term that is used in the study, FTR, which is failure to rescue, is just talking about someone who dies after they've had a complication. They haven't been rescued from that complication after surgery. A really worrying finding that we've found. The important thing to take away is there's something we can do about that. That's a much easier thing to try and change than trying to stop people having complications in the first place.
Is this really a case of it getting worse before it gets better?
I hope it doesn't continue getting worse. I think this is a real call to action, this data. There has been a lot of focus in New Zealand recently on wait lists with surgery. I think this study is a big reminder that we need to take a look at the whole journey and focus on what happens after people have operations as well.
From the data, from the study, what are recommendations that could hopefully help make this maybe gap a little less wide?
There are things that the health system needs to do. It's really disappointing that Te Akawhai Order, the Māori Health Authority, was disestablished. I have encouraged surgeons at lots of different places to go away and look at their day-to-day practice and how they make decisions for Māori patients, and how we might be treating people differently, even when they're in the same situation as others. Please speak up and let people know about it. Make sure that your concerns are heard, or if it's your whānau member or your family member, be there for them and help support them through the time in hospital, because that recovery after major surgery, that's a really important time.
Do you then think representation matters, to have more of maybe our Indigenous Māori people within the health system, or does there need to be better training for those who are already there?
I think both. Having a healthcare workforce that looks like and is like and can serve our entire community is really important. I've seen that play out firsthand when I worked at Middlemore Hospital here in Auckland, and I've seen how much it means to people having a doctor that is like them. But equally, not all of us can be everything. So we need to make sure that for all of our doctors, all of our nurses, everyone who's working in the healthcare system can provide culturally safe and responsive care so that we can look after our communities.
It's an important message indeed. That was doctoral candidate in surgery at the Waipapa Taumata Rau University of Auckland, Dr. Cameron Wells. He was speaking there with Aggie Tupo. Well, almost 90 years ago, pioneering pilot Amelia Earhart vanished after taking off from Papua New Guinea, flying across the Pacific Ocean in an attempt to fly around the world. And ever since, people have been investigating her disappearance.
On July 2, 1937, Earhart and navigator Fred Noonan took off in this specially built Lockheed Electra, starting the last legs of their around-the-world flight with a 2,500-mile jump from New Guinea to tiny Howland Island. Somehow, Earhart missed. She radioed she would recover by flying on a north-south line of position that should run through Howland. Instead, modern-day searcher Rick Gillespie believes it took her to Nicomororo.
Nicomororo Island, which is part of Kiribati, was on Amelia Earhart's flight path and has long been theorised as to where she might have crash-landed. But 5,000 kilometres northwest in the northern Mariana Islands, elders claim that Earhart was seen in Saipan with stories that she may have been captured by Japanese soldiers. And now CNMI Congresswoman Kimberly King-Hines has written to US President Donald Trump requesting that documents about Amelia Earhart be declassified. And Congresswoman Kimberly King-Hines does join me now on the line from the CNMI. Congresswoman, I should say, welcome to Pacific Beat.
Half a day, no worries.
Now, look, let's start at the beginning. You've spoken with community members who have spent years looking for answers to Amelia Earhart's disappearance. What stories have they shared with you?
Well, I think, you know, you gave a little news clip, a soundbite about just the story, right? And the story here is that, you know, there's eyewitness testimony that she has been seen here, and that there has been engagement between Amelia Earhart and the locals. And, you know, these stories have been repeated over time. And now we have a population who are in their 80s, 90s, who, you know, have been advocating for the recognition of her presence here in the CNMI. And so, this has been an ongoing for many, many years. And so this is why I've made the decision to request for these files to be declassified.
Yeah, if we can put our conspiracy hat on for a second, because I'm curious to know, why would this information even need to be classified? Like, I suppose, why would it be a national secret, for instance, that she went down?
You know, I'm not quite sure, but I think it has a lot to do with the fact that she was captured by the Japanese, right? And the manner in which she was treated. But I don't know, and I'm not going to, go down that rabbit hole. All that I'm trying to do is answer the call from a constituent to get more information. And that's why we sent out the letter.
Now, you've obviously sent out the letter. Have you had any response yet?
We have not received a response, but, you know, it takes time, right? The president's quite busy at the moment.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And what documents do you think the U.S. government might have in response to Earhart's disappearance?
So what's interesting is that some time ago, we are in the 119th Congress, and in doing our research, during the 103rd Congress, there was an attempt to be able to get these files declassified. I think there was a Senate bill that was coming out from that particular Congress, specifically from a senator from Hawaii who made that request, right? And so, you know, there has been inquiries before, but it never it never materialized, right, in terms of getting the answers that people are seeking. And so we're just making another attempt, and I'm hoping this time, if there are such records, that, you know, that enough time has passed so that whatever that's there could be shared with the public. And if it's not there, that a statement could be made that there are no files related to Amelia Earhart as it relates to her presence in the CNMI, so that we can give people some closure who really believe in this story.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Kyle Evans, and I'm chatting with CNMI Congresswoman Kimberly King-Hines, who has written to Donald Trump to see if declassified documents may hold the secrets to Amelia Earhart's disappearance. Kimberly, the CNMI is a very interesting history I've always found, particularly in the sense that it was obviously controlled by Japan prior to the Second World War. Given that this theory centres around that she might have been captured by Japanese soldiers, is it worth asking if the Japanese government has any files lying around?
Well, so that would be the next step, right? I think it'd be a multi-pronged approach. But first, we're going this route because it's we are a U.S. jurisdiction. And then if we don't get anything, the next step would be to get the assistance of the Department of State to make those inquiries.
And, you know, President Trump, he's obviously, he's loved the idea of declassifying some files in the past, others not so much. What do you think he will say in regards to this one?
You know, I'm not sure, but I'm hoping that he sees the value of responding to a community request, and I'll leave it at that.
And has there been attempts in the past is this the first attempt that you know of to request these documents be shared with the public?
No, this is not the first time. Back some time ago, there was a Senate bill that was introduced to get the administration to declassify these files. And so, you know, there must be some underlying thought, right, or belief that there, you know, that such files exist. I don't know. The only thing I can do is ask.
And if the documents hypothetically are released, you know, what impact do you think that could have on, you know, A, solving the mystery, but B, the identity and the history of the Northern Mariana Islands?
Well, you know, there's this woman by the name of Marie Castro who's made it her life's work to be able to share the story and to get the world to believe that Amelia Earhart, you know, was on Saipan and that she did, you know, pass away here, right? And she's written a book about it, and you know, she's been a strong community advocate in terms of sharing that story. And you know, Marie is our elder. We have a lot of respect for our elders here in the CNMI, and there's no reason not to believe that she truly believes that, you know, this is in fact the story. And so the impact would be, one, to honor the work of our Manomku or our elders with regards to this issue, right? But I think generally speaking, there's a lot of conspiracy theories, as you have stated, with regards to what actually happened to Amelia Earhart. And so, you know, the truth would be good, right?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, look, it's sort of leads to my next question, which in some ways is fitting to end with, but it's been almost 90 years since she disappeared. What do you think it is about this mystery that keeps us all so captivated all these years later?
Well, I think she's a fascinating woman to begin with, right? She's the first woman to attempt to fly around the world. And there's something, you know, romantic and just heroic about those endeavors, and people want to know what actually happened, right? And there's a lot of conspiracy as to what her role is with regards to, you know, the war in and of itself, right, as a woman. And so it's interesting. I'm fascinated by it. I want to know the truth, and this is why we're going this route.
Yeah, look, so am I. So are many millions of people, I'm sure. And hey, look, I hope those documents reveal that Saipan may have been the place that she ended up. But I guess we'll wait and see. Just make us a promise that when he does reply, that you'll let us know.
Absolutely.
Congresswoman, thank you very much for joining us on Pacific Beat today.
Have a great day and half a day from the CNMI.
Likewise. That was CNMI Congresswoman Kimberlyn King-Hines speaking to me there from the Northern Mariana Islands.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
To sport now, where the decision by NRL star Payne Haas to switch his allegiance from Australia to Samoa has been hailed as a huge boost for the squad by team manager Hainan Laybun. Laybun, who works alongside Donga's head coach Christian Wolf with the Dolphins NRL team, says Haas's decision to play for his country of heritage could just tip the balance for others who are considering making the same move. Wolf himself believes the Haas switch can only strengthen the international game in the Pacific, but for now, both Samoa and Donga are still rated as Tier 1 nations behind Australia and New Zealand. However, Hainan Laybun says the label is misleading because the commonly held belief is that it's based on the IRL's rating of the Pacific teams, and that's wrong.
You know, to have someone of Payne's standing at the game commit to Samoa is big for Tour Samoa, but it's also big for the wider community. And ultimately, like Payne said himself, it's a decision that's personal to each individual. But I'm sure Payne's decision to play for Samoa will inspire many people, not just to want to play for Tour Samoa, but also to have pride in the team and take pride in their Samoan heritage as well.
And if you take a look at the potential team sheet for Tour Samoa when they come up against the Tonga in the Pacific Nations Championships, it's looking ever more impressive. But I suppose on the one hand, that's great. You're getting stronger and stronger, but it must, I guess, also increase pressure to produce results.
Yeah, I think it's exciting. Our president, Phil Putifasiovasa, said ahead of the announcement for Payne that, you know, it is one of the dreams and one of the goals for the board of Tour Samoa to have all of the Samoan eligible players to declare for Tour Samoa. You know, we've already got players like Stephen Crichton and Jerome Luai, junior bowler, high-quality players and senior leaders in the NRL. Payne coming across as another really high-quality player that wants to represent Samoa and wants to represent their heritage. So I definitely think it's exciting and something for all of the Samoan community to look forward to at the end of the year, particularly the game against Tonga, because there is such a special rivalry and also a close relationship between those two nations. And it certainly will be a celebration and a great game, that game later in the year.
It's going to be quite a night, isn't it?
It sure will be. And I think it reflects the growth in the NRL. You know, out of its playing group, over 50% are of Pacific Island heritage. And so you have a large group of our NRL players and NRLW players that are of Samoan and Tongan heritage. And there's such a close relationship between the two nations and the communities are very close. And that has created a, you know, really strong but also friendly rivalry between the two nations. And I was talking to Christian Wolf the other day and he was saying that it's been a long time since Samoa and Tonga have actually played each other in Australia and New Zealand, where, you know, a lot of our communities are based. So it's certainly going to be a blockbuster game. And I know a lot of our players are really excited to be a part of, and a lot of our community are really keen to see.
Must be quite an interesting dynamic working alongside Christian Wolf at the Dolphins as you do, but then being separately involved with different Pacific nations at international level. You've got to be a bit careful sometimes what you say.
Christian and I work really closely together. And, you know, we share our passion for Pacific Island football, and yeah, I'd say 99% of the time we're on the same team. And then obviously when Samoa and Tonga play against each other, will be a different feeling for both of us for that week.
What was his reaction to the news of Payne Haas?
Christian was involved when Jason Tomalolo made the decision in 2017 to commit to Tonga. That was such a big moment for International Rugby League and such a big moment for Pacific Island Rugby League as well, because Jason at the time was, and he still is, he's a leading player in the game and had such a big influence in the game. For him to leave the Kiwis and commit to Tonga was huge, and Payne alluded to it in the press conference that that decision inspired a lot of players of his generation. And so Christian, I think he wants to see International Rugby League be strong and be successful, and for that you want lots of competitive teams. So Payne coming to Tour Samoa does that, and hopefully Payne can be similar to Jason and inspire future generations to do the same.
In terms of level at the moment, where does Tour Samoa stand? Are you still officially ranked as Tier 2, or are you now officially ranked as Tier 1, or has the International Rugby League not quite made their mind up yet?
Yeah, there's a bit of misunderstanding around the tiers, which I think confuses public discourse on that. The tiers relate to more than just, you know, I call it the elite national team's performance. So the tier rankings relate to size of the organisation, national programs, participation levels, national competitions. And the reality is it's very unlikely for a nation other than New Zealand, England, Australia to reach a Tier 1 status under the current International Rugby League rules. So I think a lot of people misunderstand the Tier 1, Tier 2, thinking it's purely based on the quality of the players that are in those teams or the performance of those teams. As it stands under the International Rugby League system, we're Tier 2, and so is Tonga, and so is a lot of Pacific Island nations. And like I said, there's more factors that are involved in that ranking than simply who's in the team.
Talking about what's happening in the islands, in Samoa in particular, are you aware as to whether the NRL in Samoa will get any of this money linked to the PNG deal? Because there's supposed to be $250 million on offer over 10 years, and my understanding is it would be shared between Samoa, Tonga and Fiji.
I haven't seen any public confirmation information or anything. I know the NRL and Peter Villanis and Andrew Abdo, they're committed to wanting to see the Pacific Island Rugby League thrive. And I know there's a lot of discussions happening in the background where, you know, they want rugby league to be the number one sport of the Pacific. You know, they think with how popular the NRL is at the moment and, you know, how much interest there is in the game and how many Pacific Island heritage they're actually playing in the NRL, that there's a real opportunity to make that happen. And so I know there's been a lot of positive discussions take place and, you know, certainly look forward to what opportunities can come out of that.
Hayden Laban, team manager for Toa Samoa, and their showdown with Tonga will be played out in Brisbane on Sunday, October 26th, in the second round of the Pacific Championships. Can't wait for that one. And Hayden was speaking there with Richard Hewitt. And that does take us to the end of Pacific Beat, but we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned though on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. My name's Kyle Evans, filling in for Agi Tupou. Have a great day.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favourite podcast app to listen.